Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Oh my gosh, I used up all my energy doing that opening. I am so
A little tired tonight?
I'm a little tired. So this weekend I did scout camping with four of the five kids. The girls' troop and the boys' troop went on a joint camping trip. And we went to New Hampshire. And it was a scout camp at the foot of Mount Monadnock. And apparently, I should Google this, in fact, because you know those facts that kind of get thrown around, sort of urban legend-y? And like, you know, I had to verify that. So we camped at this scout camp that's at the foot of Mount Monadnock. And everyone always says, oh, Mount Monadnock is the second most hiked mountain in the world or in the United States, or it's the most, or it's, you know, or whatever. So I don't know how anyone knows what the most is or not, but I'm going to Google this most hiked mountain. Okay. And we're going to see if we have any data on this. So the world's 10 most climbed mountains from traveler.com Australia. Okay. So if it's from Australia, it must be accurate, right? Because why would they don't have any bias in favor. So Mount Fuji, number one.
Not unexpected.
Not surprising. 300,000 people a year climb to the snowy tip of Japan's highest mountain. Mount Monadnock, USA. Proximity to population can also explain the popularity of Mount Monadnock, an otherwise unprepossessing mountain.
In other words, it's close to lots of cities.
Like often touted as the second most climbed mountain on Earth. In the U.S. state of New Hampshire, it's just a two-hour drive from Boston and less than 5 hours from New York. It only rises to 965 meters above sea level, so barely touches the bars of mountain. It does barely touch the bars of mountain. But best guess figures suggest around 125,000 hikers climb Mount Monadnock each year. And,
well, there you go.
And
not
our
just
scouts,
an urban, not just an urban legend.
Nope. Craig Patrick in Ireland.
Don't ask me how to pronounce it. Don't know.
Wait, didn't you study Irish? Don't you even just know how to say the words?
My pronunciation was never like my most stellar feature.
I'm always telling people, oh, Melanie, she speaks Irish.
Yeah. My first year of Irish, the professor had been sort of dragooned into teaching it. He didn't really want to. He knew Irish, but his background was linguistics. And he really just wanted to be teaching a linguistics class or an Irish drama class, which I actually took Irish drama with him later. He did not want to be teaching Introduction to Irish. He didn't like the textbook, and the amount of Irish that we learned was
sort of like Jenny's daughter's Spanish class, which is a whole nother tangent we're not going to go into.
No. Anyway, my second year, we learned more with I learned more Irish with Donna Wong than I did with Phil O'Leary. So there you go.
There you go. Anyway, Craig Patrick. we're really off the tangent here. Craig Patrick is a pilgrimage site.
Right.
In Ireland, where Patrick is said to have spent 40 days and nights fasting and praying on top. So pilgrims have, for centuries, pilgrims go on the last weekend in July, known as Reek Sunday, to commemorate the saint. On that weekend alone, up to 30,000 people ascend the peak. Sometimes barefoot.
Well, Fuji is kind of a pilgrimage, right? Because
it's a
Japanese pilgrimage.
Yes.
But Mount Monadnock is not really a pilgrimage site. It's just a tourist destination.
There's an old Japanese saying that a wise person climbs Fuji once, but only a fool does it twice. That goes for Mount Monadnock. So what happened is, we went up Friday night to this camp, and we were supposed to caravan and then you know how it always goes, like, okay, we're all leaving from the parking lot together, and we get out into the traffic of the town. We get to the first stoplight, we get separated, and we never see each other again until we're in the place 2 hours away. Like, it's just the way it is. So that's what happens. So we got there first, our van, so me and the four oldest kids, and we got there. We had to have, like, the camp director, you know, help us find. It was so dark in the wilds of New Hampshire. No lights, little dirt roads, and this little path that was, oh, yeah, no, you drive up there with the van. Up the path? Oh, it's a road. Don't worry. You're fine. Like, if I get stuck, I'm going to be so mad. But no, it was fine. So it was up and around the corner. And it was a really nice camp. They're thinking of maybe going there for a summer camp next year. But it was a nice camp. They had these wooden platforms that the tents went up on. And there's a big fire ring in the middle. You know, all the standard scout camp things. It was pit toilets. So that's the downside. I mean, it's camping. So, you know, whatever. But the kids were not enthused about it. But there was a lake right there, which is beautiful, beautiful weather. And most of the scouts went on a hike up Mount Monadnock. Now, supposedly, this is, like you said, if it's the second most hiked mountain in the world, it's probably not that hard of a hike. Well, I have a feeling that Adam, one of the scout leaders, decided to go the more difficult route.
The hard way?
Yeah, so I didn't go, and our four kids didn't go on the hike because he kept saying, well, it's going to be kind of rigorous. So if you're not really up for it, I'm like, oh, this is not going to be. I have experience that has given me wisdom, and I have learned that when some people start suggesting that it might be something that should be easy is not going to be, it's probably not going to be, and it's better avoided, and which was the truth.
Our kids would have melted.
Yeah.
They don't have the stamina yet. They could get there someday, but right now they do not have the stamina.
I think Bella could have made it, but the boys just, I mean, Anthony has this long-term thing that has to do with Lyme disease and just these issues. So, you know, and Ben and Sophie, they're all getting over being sick with bronchitis and whatnot. I'm like, that. No, discretion is the better part of valor. We're going to hang out at the campsite. And we had a blast. So it was the five of us plus Makiba. She's the scoutmaster for the girls troop. She was there. And there was no wood at the campsite, which was kind of weird. The scout camps usually have wood at the sites. But in any case, our kids spent the day going into the woods, pulling logs, you know, fallen trees and logs out and sawing them up into firewood, and we had a huge pile of firewood. So they got plenty of exercise. Let me tell you, we didn't even burn it all.
They were tired and sore. Well, so you left wood for the next people.
Yes, we did.
Which is a very nice scout thing to do.
It is a very nice scout thing to do. And we also took time to, you know, explore the camp and walk around and see all the sites and that sort of stuff. So it was a good day. We had fun, lots of animals. When we've pulled up, it's like as soon as we pull up and open the door, we hear the screeches of what Isabella identified as a great horned owl, like right there. It had to have been right in the trees of our campsite. It was so close and loud. But we saw turkeys and we saw the chubbiest little nuthatches. They were like all getting fat for the winter.
Cute.
They were very cute. And so that was fun. And then we almost ran into a deer on the way home. Did I tell you about that?
Yeah.
So we were driving back, and the car in front of us had to slam on the brakes because as a deer bounded across the road, a mother deer, a doe, because the fawns were still sitting on the side of the road on the other side. They were like trying to go and weren't going, and like, man, I'm so glad I didn't hit one of them. That would have really stunk. So other things about it, it was cold the first night. It got down about 40.
Bella said it was really cold the first night and she shivered all night long. So the second night she overcompensated and dressed super warm, and then she was broiling and she woke up hot and
had to
strip off some layers.
Yes, it was. That is exactly right. So the first night I underdressed for the night, did not have my winter bag. And so I was chilly. In fact, I like in the middle of the night, I put a shirt on. Like I don't like to sleep with a shirt on. I get overheated, but except when it's really cold, and it was cold enough that I needed a shirt. So I put a shirt on. And then I did not get leg cramps. I always, when I'm sleeping in a tent, I get leg cramps like crazy. So I have to be very careful. So I did not get leg cramps this time, thank God. But the second night was warmer, so it was nice. I mean, I don't have a problem with sleeping when it's 40 degrees out. That's comfortable. As long as I have, you know, as long as I'm prepared for it. So that was nice. And food situation was okay. As usual, Adam, one of the Scoutmasters, he brought big, thick porterhouse steaks for all the guys. So that we didn't have to eat whatever the scouts were throwing together for themselves, which is incomplete, not sufficient for an adult male that way. The boys made little personal pizzas things, these little round pizza pucks that were not good eats. I felt bad for them that eating those. They were burnt on the bottom, undercooked on top. They just did not do a good job with it. They really need to help them figure out the boys and girls. They really need help figuring out how best to cook decent meals on camping. They leave it too much to them.
Maybe if the adults were not eating a separate meal, the adults would be a bit more invested in making sure that the kids' meals were edible.
Yeah, that's what I keep saying.
Just a thought.
What should have happened is adults said, okay, you want to make pizzas? Okay, this is what we do. Need Dutch ovens so that it cooks from the top and the bottom. Mm-hmm. You know, like do the whole... teach them, lead them, you know, it's one of my frustrations. There are different philosophies of scout being a scout leader. One is very hands-off. It's scout led. They do it all. They don't know anything. That's the whole point. We're here to help them and teach them and guide them. You know, and that's the other philosophy is guiding. I mean, you could do that too much and just take over and do everything for them, but you don't want to do that either. But anyway, so it was a good weekend. We got up early this morning. It's Sunday. We got up Sunday morning, packed up as usual, ate a light breakfast. I stopped in Dunkin' Donuts on the way back. It was so funny. Sophie was like, was nearly asleep in the front seat of the van as we left the campground, the camp. And 15 minutes later, Dunkin' Donuts pull in there. She had a coffee. I had a coffee. And then 10 minutes back on the road, 10 minutes, she and Isabella are singing show tunes, like, you know, songs from the musical Anastasia for the next hour. It was funny. It's like, give Sophie a little coffee and she's a whole different person.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I spent so much time telling adults it is okay for kids to drink coffee. Coffee will not stunt their growth. That is an old wives' tale. Frankly, coffee is better for kids than all that soda you'd pump it into them. Oh, and the juice, all that sugar. Never, I mean, this tends more caffeine in a Coke than there is in a coffee. I mean, it's just, yeah. Anyway, it drives me crazy. So that was my weekend. How was your weekend without the rest of us, just you and Lucy?
It was very quiet. Very quiet. Lucy and I had a great time. So on Friday night, since you guys were leaving so early, we ordered pizza for everyone. Well, Lucy doesn't really like pizza very much. She'll eat it sometimes, but she really doesn't.
The legacy of her allergies.
Yeah. So it was not one of the nights when she felt like dealing with pizza. So after everybody took off, Lucy and I went to her choice, Taco Bell. And she had three tacos.
Uh-huh.
And she was very, very happy with her three tacos. And it was a cheap date.
That is a cheap date. Three tacos is it? Man, I would have taken you to Taco Bell every night if you wanted three tacos.
Uh-huh. So then we were not really close to the beach, but we were about 20 minutes from the beach.
Yeah.
So I said, well, we could go home or we could take a drive. And she opted for take a drive. So we drove down to Nantasket Beach and we had a nice sunset walk on the beach.
The pictures were beautiful.
It was gorgeous. The sun was setting. Now, the beach doesn't face west.
Right. It's the Atlantic Ocean.
But it's kind of not exactly directly facing east either. So yeah. The sunset is kind of on one side of the beach.
The beach technically, I think, faces south.
Right. So basically, there's part of the beach is heading in an easterly direction.
Right. So
I mean, a westerly direction. So like as you're going down towards the lighthouse, the sun is setting like down that way.
Right. Right.
Anyway, the sunset was gorgeous. We walked until it was almost dark, and then we turned around and walked back along the beach in the dark. I mean, it wasn't super dark. There's like a road along the beach, and it's a very well lit road. So it's not like we were stumbling around in the dark, but it was nice. Then we got some ice cream and we came home and we watched Brave, which Lucy did not remember seeing because the last time we watched it, I think she was like 2 or 3.
Yeah. Yeah.
She loved it. She thought it was awesome. And we made popcorn and did movie night. It was fun. We stayed up until like midnight, which she is such a night owl.
Yeah.
Then on Saturday, we just kind of took it easy and hung out around the house. I did a lot of cleaning. She watched some Rebels and Clone Wars. I think Clone Wars. And then Saturday night, we went out for Vietnamese to our favorite pho restaurant. And she had two spring rolls and a gigantic bowl. It was actually this small, but
for her it was
gigantic bowl of soup. She was so happy. And again, not a super expensive meal. So that was nice. And then Saturday night, we watched The Incredibles, which again, she did not remember. I don't know if she's even ever seen it. She thought it was awesome. She really loved it. She was laughing and it was fun. She's like a really pleasant person to spend time with. She got a little bit bored a few times, which is why I ended up letting her watch as much Clone Wars as she wanted.
Right. She's used to having 4 siblings around.
Right. But she mostly just entertains herself. Like I was cleaning most of the day and she was just kind of bopping around, hanging out, having fun. It's a nice quiet weekend. I got so much more cleaning done than I do. Like I can never get very much done around the house when there's lots of people around. I don't know. It's so much easier when it's just me, and Lucy almost doesn't count because she's
so quiet.
She's quiet and she's not really underfoot much.
Good.
I mean, she probably thought I was very boring. But.
At one point we were thinking about whether we could take her with us, you know, as a sort of Weebelow adjunct, but I felt like that would have been asking too much. So at least this time, once we get closer to her crossing over and becoming a scout, like a BSA scout, that might be more possible, but
yeah,
it's something closer. If it were closer, if it was like Camp Squano or something like that, that might have been different too. But anyway, so it was good. Tiring. I'm kind of tired today. Like this is I'm dragging. So hopefully it doesn't show too much. But yeah. And then we went to the Last Chance Mass at 6 o'clock at St. Clair's. I was going to say Cecilia, but St. Clair's. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
So let's talk about food we made this week. So earlier this week, I made a new dish called pasta con ceci, which is Sicilian pasta with chickpeas. And you can imagine, I saw Sicilian pasta with chickpeas. Sicilian, that's right up my alley. We should try that. This was a recipe I got out of the Boston Globe's food section a while ago. Or not a while ago. This was a recent one. And it's basically... It's very simple. It's olive oil, garlic, tomato paste, a little bit of crushed red pepper, 2 cans of chickpeas, water, salt, ditalini, or other small tubular pasta, chopped fresh spinach, grated pecorino romano cheese, and lemon juice. And then, so you basically, you cook the garlic in the oil in the Dutch oven over low heat. Then you add the tomato paste and the crushed red pepper, and you kind of cook it, stir it in, break it down until the tomato paste kind of darkens. That's the idea. You want to give it some extra caramelization. Then you add the chickpeas and their liquid. You keep the aquafaba, the liquid that the chickpeas come in. And then you add the water, the 3 cups of water as well, and some salt. You bring it to a boil, lower the heat, simmer it for 10 minutes. It's really quick. Then you add the pasta. You simmer that for 8 minutes until the pasta is tender but has a little bite. Add the spinach, cook another minute. And then off heat, you stir in the cheese and the lemon juice, and then you serve it. So, I mean, start to finish, including preparing the ingredients, is, you know, 45 minutes an hour. It's, as you might have noticed, there's no meat in it. The chickpeas are a protein, so this would be like a good Lenten, like Friday meal. Right. But we ended up having chicken thighs with it, right?
Yeah.
That was the night we did the chicken thighs too. So we had like chicken, like bone in chicken thighs.
The kids were not a fan of the pasta.
Yeah, I don't know. It was lacking something.
I thought it was good.
Yeah, no, it was good. It needed more tomato.
It definitely needed more tomato.
Like it asked for 2 tablespoons in tomato paste. It needed more.
It actually reminded me of a soup that I had in Rome. It was sort of a similar flavor profile.
This would have been a good soup if you'd added like chicken broth and then some more like vegetables, like some carrots or something in there.
Yeah.
This could become a really good soup. A pasta chickpea soup with the spinach and the cheese.
I really liked the combination of the chickpeas and the spinach and the cheese with the pasta. Like, it was nice.
Yeah.
And yet it was kind of brothy. So if you would just up to the broth a little bit more, it would definitely be more soupy and less.
I might want to try that sometime, is to make it more a soup, make a pasta con chichi soup.
Yeah.
So that was one we made. And then today you were making a new dessert, a new to you dessert.
Yeah. A friend of mine shared a photo on Facebook of this peach and frangipani crostata. And I thought that it looked really good. And I asked her for the recipe and she gave it to me and I copied and pasted it. And I don't know. It used pre-made puff pastry. And I'm not really a puff pastry person. Like, I don't have, I think I've made something with puff pastry like once before ever. And I don't know if like the puff pastry I had was not really what I was supposed to be using. Like, are there multiple kinds of puff pastry or something? But the pastry just kind of fell apart and all of the filling just spread across the sheet pan. Fortunately, I put it on a sheet pan that had sides. Aren't
you glad I suggested that?
Because it sort of turned into a very thin layer of doughy. The puff pastry did not puff. It just was like dough. And then the frangipani just kind of flowed all over the place with the peaches in it. It just made like a, I don't know. It was not what my friend had posted a picture of. That's for sure.
Yeah.
It tasted okay. Like, the flavor profile was good. Peaches and frangipani is like almond flavored. And peaches and almond is just really an amazing combination. So the flavor was good. It's just it just looked like a disaster.
It tasted good. It wasn't flaky at all. Like it wasn't puff pastry flaky.
There was no flakiness at all.
Yeah. But the taste was there. I mean, the almond and peach, that tastes good. But like, I think it's like you said, that there was like twice as much filling, I think, as there should have been.
Yeah, I kind of have a vague memory of maybe my friend saying that she only used half of the filling that the recipe made. Like, she sort of, it was sort of two recipes. Like, she had the crostata recipe and then the cream recipe, the frangipani recipe, sort of underneath it. And so I think that what happened is when I cut and pasted it, I like missed the direction to only use half of the frangipani.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I don't know. Anyway, something. It was a valiant effort.
Yeah, it tasted good, but yeah, we'll try it again for another time. A little some modifications. See, just because we talk about like all the yummy food we make all the time, it's not always like super successful. You know, I think that's one of the things I want to get across. Like there are happy failures and, you know, mediocre results or whatever. We just keep trying again. I think that's the key. All right, so let's talk about what we've been reading and watching. You and I watched Thor: Love and Thunder.
We did.
Your impression?
It was a fun movie. I don't think
it was funny.
Funny. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think it stood up to the rest of the Thor movies. It wasn't as good as...
It wasn't as good as Ragnarok.
No.
No, certainly not. I think... It didn't have Loki, and I think that was a big loss. I think Thor and Loki together...
Right, because Thor without Loki is funny, goofy.
It's goofy.
But...
Loki provides a sharpness and contrast.
Yeah, and I think, he sharpens Thor, like steel sharpening steel sort of thing.
Also, lovesick Loki is... I mean, lovesick Thor is kind of meh. And to be honest... I didn't really like Thor all that much in Avengers Infinity War, Endgame, Fat Thor. There were some funny moments, but it was kind of disappointing, too.
Yeah. And I kind of felt like the whole Jane plotline was missing something.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt like, I don't know, I just...
Well, it came out of nowhere and had that campy, weird, like... flashback to when they were dating and they were like this comedic, we're a normal couple except one of us is, it's like that, remember the when before Ragnarok came out, there was like the Doug, his roommate, Thor's roommate, and it was like, what if your roommate was one of the Norse gods who's an Avenger now, and how weird and awkward that would be. It's like they extended that into a movie.
Yeah, kind of. Like the whole... None of the plots really kind of came together.
Yeah.
And there was the whole weird, like, Zeus thing that just didn't quite work.
Which was too long. The whole Zeus thing was...
way too long.
Yeah. Russell Crowe was amusing, but it was, yeah, that whole set piece was took up too much time. It's like Waititi has... He's kind of... grabbed onto this one shtick and isn't willing to let it go, you know, like the whole Love and Thunder thing they explain at the end, except the I'm not going to spoil it, but the explanation is that should have been the movie. Like the whole Love and Thunder bit, we're now Love and Thunder, that should have been the movie. Like, except instead of the last 30 seconds, it was kind of weird. Yeah, the goats were the best part.
The goats were fun.
The screaming goats. They were so funny.
Because in Norse mythology, Thor
had a cart.
Had a cart.
A magical cart pulled by
goats.
Yes.
I mean, that's funny.
Right, especially if you know the mythology. But these were like, if you've ever seen online, like the viral videos of like screaming goats that scream that sound like people.
There is a kind of goat.
There's a kind of goat that screams like that. Now imagine them being, you know, eight feet tall and pulling this flying Norse Viking boat and screaming the whole way. It was funny. Like at one point they ran into a planet. Like a very small planet. And he's like, boom. Ah! And they scream. It was just, that was funny. But yeah, I don't know. Well, see, the whole Jane Foster thing where she becomes the female Thor was in the comics. And so I felt like they decided, oh, we have to do that. That's edgy and cool. Jane Foster becoming Thor, picking up the hammer, and now she's Thor. How edgy and cool is that? Okay, that's fine, but that's not enough to make a movie. Like, being edgy and cool isn't a movie. It's the beginning of an idea. And I just felt like they didn't go anywhere with that.
Right, like the villain was just not... Well, they started off by making him a sympathetic character.
Right, well... His motivation was to kill the gods because the gods are cruel and capricious.
But you've kind of felt sorry for him because, I mean, his motivation.
He was justified because his god didn't care about him, his daughter dying. And
his god was cruel and capricious.
That's not a spoiler. That literally happens in the first 2 minutes of the movie. So it's not really much of a spoiler.
So on the one hand, like, I kind of felt like I agree with him. I mean, he's taking it too far and killing all the gods who weren't.
He didn't stop at his own bad god. He kept going.
On the other hand, he kind of had a point because for the most part, most of the gods were kind of cruel and capricious and self-centered and not.
Most of the gods of the Marvel Universe that we've encountered so far have not been much in the way of gods, have they?
No.
Well, on the other hand, it kind of felt like this was somebody's commentary on religion. Like, having gods is a bad thing. Yeah, I don't know. It was a bit of it was kind of a mess. I mean, with a lot of funny bits, but it was kind of a mess. It was funny. It was amusing. I'm glad we watched it.
It was an entertaining movie. Just doesn't stack up to the rest of.
It's not a great movie. I'm not looking forward to watching it again with the kids.
We could probably skip it with the kids.
Well, that's the thing is over the past year, half of the Marvel movies, or more than half, are not. We're like, oh, I'm not going to watch that with the kids. We're not going to watch Eternals with the kids. We're not going to watch Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness with the kids, or maybe we will. And now there's Thor: Love and Thunder. Like, that's a bad track record. I feel like those three movies have all been lesser than all of what came before. It's and in fact, the streaming series have been far better.
That's true.
Which is the same thing with Star Wars. The three movies were not as good as the streaming series that we've gotten.
That's true. I loved Rebels and Clone Wars and Mandalorian a lot better than I liked the
sequel trilogy.
Or the prequel trilogy, for that matter.
Right, right. Yeah. And the same thing. Like, I've enjoyed Hawkeye and Ms. Marvel and Falcon and Winter Soldier and Vision, WandaVision, all better than any of those, the most recent three movies, like I just mentioned. So it's interesting. Oh, I didn't mention the Spider-Man one. That one was okay. The Spider-Man was good.
I still haven't seen that one.
Yeah. That's coming up after we finish Hawkeye. And then, the Black Widow was okay.
I liked Black Widow a lot, actually. It was fun.
Yes, it was. Shang-Chi was good. I liked that.
It was. Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see. This has not been a good phase of Marvel, the MCU. All right. And so as I mentioned, we're watching Hawkeye with the kids. We watched episode 2 today. This was the LARPing episode.
I love this episode. It's so funny. Hawkeye is just, he's not into it at all. And I liked that. Like, if he'd gotten really into it and been having a fun time, it kind of would have been less funny.
You get a feeling that Tony would, even as he snarked about it, he'd kind of get into it. You know, Tony Stark.
Right.
Steve Rogers, I don't know what Steve would do, but Falcon would kind of get into it maybe. You know what I mean? Certainly Ant-Man would.
And I think that, in fact, Clint, at some other point in his life, might have gotten more into it.
He's cynical and world weary now.
He lost his best friend. He's just barely got his wife and kids back, and he's mourning. He's not in a happy place.
Well, in fact, Kate calls him out on that, right? You know, she's talking about how he doesn't wear his heart on his sleeve. It's buried deep, deep, deep inside. He's very cynical.
In fact, that's one of the things I really like about their relationship is Kate wants him to be the hero that she thinks he should be. He wants him to be her hero. And he doesn't want to be anyone's hero. He never set out to be a hero.
He said he was a secret agent spy.
Yeah. And so she's like, your branding is all off. And he's like, what branding? I'm not trying to sell anything. Like, he's not trying to sell himself. And I think it's one of the things I like about Hawkeye is he really isn't trying to sell anything.
Right. He's just trying to, I don't know, retire even. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he's really not into the whole superhero thing.
He even gets embarrassed when people treat him like a superhero, when they want to like give him a free meal or like we talked about last time. So in this one, the other thing I notice is the having watched it all already once is the misdirection. We want you to think about this person, but not this person. But when you're rewatching it, you'll notice things about this person that you didn't notice before, where that will say, oh, that person. I'm being intentionally vague.
I am less perceptive. I was not catching on to this. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I was looking for it in that one. So, but it's also just amusing to see Kate kind of fangirling over Clint and him just not having any of it. Like she's finally, you know, she's met her hero and he's kind of disdaining her as a kid.
Yeah.
That's a tough thing.
It's tough, but it's funny.
Yeah.
And she's not, the thing is you if she were more thin skinned, you would kind of feel sorry for her, but she's just sort of,
she's not crushed by it.
She's impervious. Like she's just like, I haven't tried hard enough. I need to try harder. And she keeps trying harder and harder and harder.
She's kind of clueless.
No matter how much he tries to crush her, he can't. And I think that's what makes the dynamic work so well.
Well, isn't it like what the mom says in the first episode, like rich kids and something kids, only kids. I forget what it is. Have no sense of self-preservation or danger. I forget what it was. Rich kids and something kids. I forget.
Only kids, I think.
Yeah, might have been. And she says, and you're both. So you have no sense of self-preservation or, you know, the danger. And I think that's kind of, they're showing that like nothing stops her. She just keeps barreling ahead.
Also, interesting contrast, too, since we just watched The Incredibles, because in The Incredibles, the whole villain thing is the kid who wants to be Mr. Incredible's sidekick, who he disdains, who, you know, is so warped by that he becomes a villain.
Right.
And so this is sort of the opposite dynamic. Nothing's going to turn Kate into a villain.
I'm so glad that Lucy liked The Incredibles, because remember the time I tried to show the kids The Incredibles?
The other kids did.
They didn't want to watch it. We like ended up turning it off. I was aghast. I was shocked.
I think they were too young.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah, it was that long ago. I think they were too young.
I guess. I mean,
Lucy's like the perfect age. 9 is a good age for
The Incredibles. I mean, maybe we should try again with the others, but.
Right. I think it was. The thing is, The Incredibles is fun, but it has some really slow bits.
Yeah, I guess so.
Some of where it gets slow, it gets really slow. Like the whole Mr. Incredible as insurance agent, and it's funny.
Yeah, no, I know.
But I think it's adult funny. It's not really kid funny.
I guess. Yeah.
I mean, Lucy enjoyed it.
There's some subtlety in it.
But yeah.
Yeah. That in Brave, Merida.
Brave, she loved. She loved so much. And I realized something, actually. Mm-hmm. I realized that Fergus, Merida's dad in Brave, is Captain Ahab.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, it's not a common trope in these things.
Right. And Mordu is his white whale. I'd never like noticed that before or thought about it explicitly like that. But yeah, he's totally Ahab.
He's also Flint from Jaws. Quint. You know, from Jaws. Like, yeah, it's that trope of the force of nature that I have to conquer. And
well, but specifically, Ahab lost his leg to Moby Dick.
I suppose it's a little more on the
Fergus,
nose. Yeah.
Fergus loses his leg to Mordu. I mean, it happens off stage. And in fact, this was the first time I'd notice that the movie opens with the family on a picnic.
Yes.
And
Fergus has both legs.
And then Mordu shows up. Mom rides off with Merida. Fergus stays to fight the bear. And then we pick it up years later. And he's missing the leg.
Yeah.
Like he lost the leg at the family picnic.
Yes.
When the bear showed up. I think I missed that before.
Oh, yeah. No, I noticed that the first time.
I think the first time I saw it, Brave, I actually missed the first 10 minutes of the movie. And I'm not sure. I think this might actually have been the first time I've seen the first scene.
Okay.
Of the film.
Well, you often have your nose in your phone during movies, too. So
no, I mean, I was like out of the room the first. Okay. the first time we watched.
Of course, remember, Brave is the one where Sophie, who was probably about 7 or 8 when she first saw it, at the end of the movie, when the bears are fighting, all the kids are like cringing and holding onto pillows and cuddling up to mom and dad and hiding under a blanket. And Sophie's jumping up and down on the couch going, yes, yes, yes.
Bear fight. She was so into that fight.
That was the first moment when I was scared of Sophie. I'm like, oh, this one is going to be something. So, yeah.
She is a handful.
Well, we call her Merida, right? I mean, she's got the hair and she's got the attitude. So she's basically Merida. So I wanted to just mention the House of the Dragon, which is the Game of Thrones prequel I've been kind of watching.
Uh-huh.
I find it so boring. I'm like, it is kind of boring. It's not like Game of Thrones. It's a bunch of like royalty sitting around complaining about being royalty and like they're wandering around their castle. There's like nothing happens. I mean, sure, they have to have the obligatory like flesh scenes and a couple times the dragons roast people and oh, finally a battle. Okay, this will be interesting. They have this really, you know, bad enemy, the Crab King, who's really awful. And oh, this is going to be such a slog to defeat him through the rest of the season. Oh, okay, that was quick. Like, what was the point of this character that we've already like it was in for half an episode? It was like, it's like, I don't know. It's boring and people seem to like it. But I contrast this to The Rings of Power. That's interesting. It's stuff happening. We're seeing different places, you know, I don't know. It's, I don't know how much longer I'm going to watch House of Dragon. Cause in this last, it also, there's a strong thread of older men, young girls that they keep putting in here, like political marriages between like, and I mean, when I say young, like 10,
yeah,
and a 40-year-old man, and they're trying to make this political marriage, and you know, uncle and niece, and like just ew, like why are we doing this? This is gross. I don't know. I could stomach Game of Thrones most of the time throughout most of it, partly because there was a character I could root for, Jon Snow. He was a genuinely good character. There is no one so far in House of the Dragon where I'm going, oh, that's the good guy. There is no one, literally no one.
Yeah, I tend to give up on stories when there's no clear good guy.
There might be one, a bodyguard. But yes.
I'm not really interested.
Yeah, and he's gotten like 5 minutes of screen time. But other than that, so I'm on the edge. I may not finish the season on that. So let's talk about books. You were talking about Murderbot Diaries Volume 1 last time.
I've read the first four books. Now, the first four books are novellas, not novels. They're very short.
Yes.
And I plowed through them very quickly. Like, I think the Kindle estimated reading time was less than 2 hours for each of them.
Right.
Right. So they were boom, boom, boom. Then I got to number 5. And it wasn't available on Libby, and I'm actually waiting for the physical book because that had less of a wait time than the ebook on Libby. And sometimes I just go ahead and bite the bullet and buy them, but it was like $12, and that was a little bit too steep for me to just satisfy my need to read the next book in the series.
Right.
I like Murderbot, though. It is a really fun series, and like most stories that have to do with an artificial intelligence as your protagonist, a lot of it is about like, what does it mean to be human? You know, it's sort of like Data in Star Trek, like the non-human character who in Murderbot's case doesn't exactly want to be human, but is often treated as human and is uncomfortable with that. And I like that twist on it. Like, I don't want these people to be nice to me and treat me like a person because I am a big, scary killing machine.
Right.
Who doesn't really want to kill anybody. I just want to watch my soap operas. It's a fun character. And the stories are really good. So that was good. I also read Everything Sad is Untrue, which is sort of a semi-autobiographical it's called fiction, but it's
based on a true story.
Based on a true story. And it's autobiographical. It's the author's story. So the author, so it's about, it's told from the point of view of an 11-year-old boy. And that's really important. Your protagonist is this boy who is a refugee from Iran living in Oklahoma. And the story, he compares himself repeatedly to Scheherazade, except his, instead of trying to placate the king like Scheherazade does, he's trying to placate his school teacher.
You're referring to the 1001 Arabian Nights.
Right, 1001 Arabian Nights, sorry. So in 1001 Arabian Nights, the king is killing off like his bride every day because he's mad. He marries a new girl every day and he kills her the next morning because he's mad because his queen betrayed him. And then Scheherazade, he marries her and
she tells him a tale,
tells him a story. And he's so into the story that he doesn't kill her. And she does that for
because she doesn't tell him the ending until the next day. Right. I won't tell you till tomorrow.
So the whole way that this story is told is sort of a story within a story, within a story, within a story. And it's very digressive. And he's talking to his elementary school teacher, but he's also kind of talking to his classmates because evidently he's reading these essays out loud to his class. And so there's kind of the sense in which he's kind of like Scheherazade. He's trying to entertain them so that they'll like him because he's the dirty, smelly refugee kid that everyone makes fun of who doesn't fit in at all.
Right.
And the grist of his stories is his family history. So we find out about his parents, his grandparents, his aunts and uncles in Iran. And there's a lot of trauma in his story, like the reason why his family has to flee as political refugees from Iran. His mom's marriage to this guy in Oklahoma who is not nice. There's a lot of really bad stuff, but he kind of buries it in humor and digressions and analogies to like other stories from Persian folklore. And there's a whole lot of very self-conscious, like, I am telling you a story which is made up because I don't know the true story of what happened with my grandmother. And a lot of sort of self-conscious talking about the difference between myth and legend and history. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of weaving together these strands. And sometimes you're not really sure what's real, what's not, what's mythic, what's heroic. It was a really good story, but it took me a while to get into it. Like I put it down about a third of the way in because it was just not gripping. And that's when I read all the Murderbot books. But then I came back to it and I was really glad I finished it because it really, like by the end of it, the last third, I couldn't put the book down. It was really gripping, but it did take a while to kind of get into the character because he does spend a lot of time just kind of being an 11-year-old boy. I mean, it's kind of fun the way it takes all of these tropes about the stories within stories of from Persian folk oral tradition and folklore. But then it also has sort of the digressiveness of 11-year-old boys who just kind of want to talk about poop.
Right. Yes. Remind me to tell you about my scout camping trip.
I mean, there was kind of a point to some of the poop stuff. Like the differences in bathrooms in Iran versus the U.S. kind of is one of his weird cultural. I don't know how to deal with the fact that bathrooms are so different from what I expect. And he thinks American bathrooms are gross.
Okay.
So there's kind of this weird, like he's definitely the fish out of water and you're kind of cringing for him, but also rooting for him at the same time.
So I think the way where it's based, where it's a true story, it's called, you know, Everything Sad Is Untrue is a True Story is the author was born in Iran, spent a couple years as a refugee before immigrating to Oklahoma at the age of 8.
Right. So I think that the core story is his own autobiography.
Right.
Where it gets into fiction is all the embroidery he does. And of course,
in the detail, probably the details. I don't think like it says with his family. So I don't think his mom was separated or whatever.
Well, possibly. I mean, in the book, he immigrates with his mom and his sister.
Okay.
His dad stays behind in Iran. It's possibly that that's what happened. And then his mom remarries. But it's also possible that some of that is embroidered. Like, you can't really tell where the autobiography ends, but he kind of says at the end, this did really happen to me. This is my life.
Okay.
That you've been reading. Was his father, did his father really smuggle a whole bunch of opium into London? Maybe. Right. Like there's these like details that are kind of wild, but possibly, I mean, maybe.
Right.
But it was really good. It's billed as a middle grade novel or young adult, like ages 12 to 18. But I think it's enjoyable for adults too.
Okay. I was trying to get a closer look at the cover. It's interesting artwork on the cover, but Amazon is not cooperating.
I think it's supposed to be a sort of magical tornado.
Yeah.
Because there's a whole thing about tornadoes, Oklahoma.
Right. I was going to say it's Oklahoma, so tornadoes would be a thing.
They are.
Cool. All right. So I think that's all the reading and watching stuff. Let's talk about this week's mass readings for the 25th Sunday in Ordinary Time. And it is the one of those gospels where, you know, Jesus' parables, where you're thinking, I'm not sure I get it. And then the priests have to get up there and go, I need to explain this one, and I'm not sure how, but. It's the rich man who had a steward who was reported to him for squandering his property, which I don't think means he was stealing it, but just that he was like as a steward.
Mismanaging it?
Mismanaging maybe? It, probably spending his money, basically, frivolously. A steward could, you know, he would be able to spend money, you know, out of the accounts with the same authority as the master. So, yeah. So the master does something strange. He says, okay, prepare a full account of your stewardship because I'm firing you. And then sends him back to work.
I want to see the books.
Yeah, but like if this were today, the boss would call HR and security and escort him from the property. Why is he sending him back to work? Because when the guy goes back to work, he's like, oh, this is bad. I know I'm done here, so I can't save my job. So what I should do is give myself a soft landing somewhere else by ingratiating myself with the people of this area and calling my boss's biggest debtors and cheating him out of his money by telling them, here, let's make a kickback deal. I'll cut down your debt. I'll pretend your debt is less than it is. And now you're my buddy. Now you owe me one.
Right.
And then the boss says, wow, how prudent of you to act so shrewdly. What? It's very confusing. It's a confusing gospel. He doesn't care about having his property being stolen?
Or, I mean, the priest offered a sort of plausible reading of, it's not so much that he doesn't care, but just like, wow, that was very shrewd of you. Like, it's possible that the master is sort of impressed with the guy's with his
ingenuity,
right? Like, wow, that was incredibly clever. I'm not going to, you know, continue to give you your job, but you know,
yeah, because he doesn't give the job back. He just says he's. That was you're very clever. The children of this world are more prudent in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light, which is a strange verse. Like, okay, like there's the level of the literal meaning, and then of the parable, and then there's what is Jesus trying to tell us here? You know, so we get bits and pieces. Oftentimes, the person who is trustworthy in small matters is trustworthy in great ones. And Father was bringing that out. Like, this is what we tell our kids. Like, you have to build trust. You know, if I give you something and you do it, then I will give you more responsibility and we'll build trust that way. You can prove yourself. But that's, you know, the gospel goes on. If you are not trustworthy with dishonest wealth, who will trust you with true wealth? What is dishonest wealth in this context? You know, it's a very... So one of the things, this is the one, you cannot serve God and mammon. You will either hate one and love the other or be devoted to one and despise the other. And I kind of was thinking about this, and what I came up with is true love is loving someone without regard for what they add to you, for what it gives to you. You know, to love God selflessly, a spouse, a child. I love you, not because you make me a better person, but because of you. That, at least that's what I should love you for, right, your own sake. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But disordered love can also seem like love, even when it also adds nothing back to the person who's loving, but it's still disordered because it's like the rich miser who has all the money he needs, but wants more, not because it will make him better, but just because he wants more, because it's more power, more strength, more reputation, you know? And so that's a disordered love. I don't know. This is a hard one for me.
I guess I've always felt like he's saying, our treasure should be, you know, storing up treasure in heaven, right?
Yes.
So how prudent are we in focusing our attention? Like, this guy, he's going after the wrong thing for the wrong reasons, but he's shrewd. He's spending a lot of time and energy going after this. Now imagine if he was spending the same amount of time and energy going after what really matters.
Well,
heavenly goods.
Well, or is it what's coming tomorrow is more important than what I have today? So I'm going to do whatever it takes today to have that promise of tomorrow, to what I need tomorrow.
Right. So what if we have that attitude towards heaven? What's coming tomorrow is more important than today.
But it's the stealing from his boss thing that gets. There's got to be a cultural context, an ancient cultural context in this.
It's kind of like Jesus, like the story of the unjust judge. I mean,
right.
In that parable, if you're trying to make one-on-one analogies, the unjust judge is God. Like the widow is petitioning and petitioning and petitioning until she wears him out and he gives her justice,
right,
just because she's annoying him. But God is not an unjust judge. So I think that sometimes in Jesus's parables, there's this weird reversal where he reverses the polarity of good and evil to make a point.
Right.
So I think that he's comparing like
a crooked steward who does anything to ensure his future. And if a crooked steward will go to these lengths to ensure his future, how much more should we, who are supposed to be good and righteous, should be doing what we can in this world to ensure our future in the next?
Right. Like we should be that diligent. We should be that.
That's shrewd.
Shrewd.
And cunning.
But shrewd, not about the things of this world, but shrewd about the things of.
Right.
The heavenly world.
Right.
Like that's the kind of.
Do what it takes.
Right. Like.
But in a good way.
Right. Make the sacrifices. Make the plans. Like.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of counterintuitive because he's not doing, you know, he's not going after a good thing for a good reason, but he is looking to the future. Like he's prudent in a twisted way, but he's prudent because he realizes I can't dig,
right,
and people don't like me. So what am I going to do? I'm going to be kicked out. Like he's looking
I'm gonna be homeless in the street.
Right. He's looking ahead to the future, which how often do we really spend time thinking about what do I need to do to assure my future? Like we're just going along, boop, 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 you know, without really thinking about the future. He's at least thinking about tomorrow. What's the next step? Death is coming. What's your next step?
Right.
He's got a plan. He's acting on it. How often do we...
It's easy to live our lives kind of like just day-to-day, moment-to-moment without planning for the future.
Right.
And the ultimate future.
Ultimate future. Right. I mean, we are all eventually
all
going to
die.
Be fired.
Fired from this life.
From this life.
Yep.
Do we have a plan?
We're fired. Our soul loaded into a cannon and shot into heaven. Hopefully into heaven, at least to our judgment.
Right. Yeah. So he's going to face judgment, not... And it's interesting, not the judgment of the master who's already passed judgment, but the judgment of the neighbors. Like, who's going to take care of me once my master's kicked me out? Like, right. He thinks he's got, so far, he's thought he's got a good thing. He's set for life. He's the steward. He'll have this is a cushy job. You'll have it until you die, right? The old faithful retainer. That's probably his retirement plan, is to work, continue working to this guy forever. And then suddenly, it's gone. Like, what do you do?
Right. So he does what he has to do to ensure his future instead of just surrendering to his fate. I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, does the master go and confront the people who owe him money and say, hey, you know, the fake promissory note? Yeah. You still owe me 100 measures of olive oil. I wonder. Although I have a feeling the master is sort of detached from his wealth. It doesn't matter to him as much.
Maybe the master is detached and says, you know what? I can be merciful to all the people who owe me money. And this guy, maybe the master was planning to be merciful anyway. And this guy has just been merciful on his behalf. Like, maybe lowering the promissory notes wasn't actually a bad thing, because God is, after all, not only just, but also merciful. And maybe the master says, if this guy can work himself, I can't continue to trust him to manage my money, but he's prudently watched out for himself. So now I don't have to worry about what he's going to do. Like, it wouldn't exactly be fair to give him a retirement package now, right, since he's been stealing from me. But this is kind of him taking care of himself, and I can sort of live with that.
Yeah,
maybe.
Well, in any case, if you have a better ideas than we do, let us know. We would love to hear from you, and we'll read those on a future episode. So let's finish up there, and we take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Bob L., Jun C., Leonides S., Frederick H., and Megan S. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. You'll find links from our discussion in our show notes at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Send your feedback to our Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com, or visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/Discord. Write a review at Apple Podcasts and share the podcast with your friends to help us grow our community and reach more listeners. Until next time, I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest. Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy. Let's Science. Find the show wherever fine podcasts are found, or at sqpn.com/science.